The Israel Report with Rolene Marks.
Hello, Rolene Marks. How are you?
Hello, Kathy Kayla. I am fine, and yourself?
Very well, thank you. Gosh, a big news day in Israel.
It is quite a big news day, and yet it has been kind of quiet since the big news this morning, which, you know, always makes me nervous. I like my big stories happening throughout the day. Makes me feel secure.
Okay, good. All right, so let's, first things first, the technical malfunction behind the deadly helicopter crash.
Okay, so we do have some preliminary results about what caused that horrendous, horrendous helicopter crash that claimed the lives of two Navy pilots yesterday. We know that the victims were Erez Sahyan as well as Chen Fogel. So what we know now, and Channel 12 released some information, although they didn't give their sources, the cause of the crash is believed to have been a severe malfunction, which prompted the pilots to engage in emergency landing, and they would have had to land in the sea. Now, I'm not too sure what the technicalities of that are, but maybe with this specific aircraft, that would have been able to happen. Now, the IAF has grounded the entire fleet of the AS-565 Panthers, which in Hebrew are called Atalef, which means that. I don't know why they didn't call them Panthers, but anyway. So what we also know is that the left side engine caught fire, and as a result, one of the doors jammed shut, so the pilots weren't able to evacuate. However, the third naval officer that was on board the helicopter managed to jump out. His name is Ron Berman. He's in hospital at the moment, Captain Ron Berman. He was extraordinary. He swam. He tried to rescue his two crew members who were rendered unconscious, it is believed, by smoke which filled the cockpit. And they drowned as a result. So they weren't killed as a result of the crash. They sadly drowned. And we don't know any more details from this. All I can pray and all I can hope is that they were completely unconscious and had no idea of what had happened to them.
Can we talk about this rabbi who has quit a 30-year career at the BBC over anti-Semitism? What's going on there? Give us
the
details.
This is extraordinary. This is really extraordinary. And I don't know about you, but it makes me think about the New York Times issue. I don't know if you guys remember, just a short couple of months ago, Barry Weiss, one of the premier journalists at the New York Times, was literally forced out. She was literally forced out by anti-Semitic sentiment, wrote a very, very vocal, controversial resignation letter about that. Now, the same basically has happened to Rabbi Rubenstein of the BBC. He unfortunately has resigned, saying that it's a crisis of anti-Semitism, that basically anti-Semitism, overt and covert at the network, has resulted in him feeling unsafe, and the whole issue around the reporting about the attack on the bus on Hanukkah just has made him feel that there's no place for him at the BBC. This is a man who has given 30 years of service to the BBC.
Okay. Any other details you want to add?
Well, let's talk about the BBC, because this is publicly funded. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation, license fees paid by the civilians or the citizens of the United Kingdom are what keeps it funded. Now, throughout its history, the BBC has come under fire for anti-Semitism. More notably, in 2004, they commissioned the Balin Report, a former senior editor, Malcolm Balin, sat and went through hours and hours of radio and television broadcasts. He looked at the imagery that was used. He looked at the kind of language that was used. And he came to the conclusion quite damningly that the BBC's reporting or their reportage on Israel and the Palestinians was extremely, extremely biased. Cut to Rabbi Rubenstein's resignation letter, and he goes on to say that, you know, he never really fit in there. He was never quite part of the club. And he says, you know, if you walk around carrying your Guardian newspaper and talking about how you voted for the Labour Party, then you are made to feel welcome. He goes on to cite several instances where anti-Semitic language was used, like the Jews being blamed for 9/11. This was in the days following the terror attacks in the United States. And he also says one of his former colleagues, who subsequently was retrenched when, you know, when they cull staff every once in a while, came to him and said, you know, there's a group of us who meet and we prayer service, but if they get out, we will be fired. So you've got to question, why is there this kind of climate at the BBC? And now, of course, we have this horrendous issue with the attack on the bus of young Jews going to light the first night of Hanukkah, and the attack on the bus by a group of Muslims who were yelling Free Palestine and hailing Hitler and all of that. And the BBC in their written report said there was anti-Muslim slurs hurled at the Muslims. Now, the British Board of Deputies have commissioned two independent forensic organizations, and the London Metropolitan Police have investigated, and anybody who understands Hebrew or speaks Hebrew like myself and has listened to the audio, you will hear the words "Tikhale Mishu Zetahuf," call someone, it's urgent. The BBC claimed that's a racial slur. Now, the results have been given, it's been escalated to the culture secretary. The BBC have not apologized, and they refuse to apologize, and even doubled down on their accusations. And this is the climate now that exists, and one has to wonder, is the BBC going the way of the New York Times, where there is just no space for any staff member who is Jewish or identifies as Zionist?
It's a very interesting situation. I mean, Chai FM is a BBC partner, so I'm very interested to know exactly what this, you know, what this bodes for.
Well, absolutely, and I think that you well within your right to ask those questions of the BBC,
yeah,
in light of the criticism that they are facing.
Yeah. All right, Rolene, I want to talk about this landmark ruling for the LGBTQ community on surrogacy.
Yes, so this is a landmark ruling that is being hailed as a great civil rights victory, not just for the LGBTQ plus community, but also for the State of Israel. So as of the 11th of January, I think that is next Tuesday, any same-sex couples or single men or trans people who want to become parents will be able to do that through surrogacy. This is a decision that's gone through the Health Ministry and the Health Ministry's Director General in conjunction with the High Court of Justice ruling on that. It's a massive, massive civil rights win for the LGBTQ community. And I think one of the most progressive rulings definitely in the region, if not the world. So really, really extraordinary.
So what happened before? You know, what is the status of adoption of same-sex couples? I mean, can they not adopt?
There have been cases where same-sex couples have been able to adopt, not necessarily in Israel, maybe out of Israel. There have been many cases of same-sex couples through surrogacy in another country, which of course is not only logistically difficult, but also very, very costly. And now this process will be able to be done in Israel. So hopefully we will have many more people feeling, you know, that their rights to become parents are now really, really entrenched and protected.
All right. And finally, so look, I don't know who's talking in the background there, but boy, are they talking loud, Rolene. It's very Israeli. I wanted to ask you, do you think that Israel is going to normalize ties with the Maldives and the Comoros?
Well, brace yourself, the Comoros and the Maldives, because you could have Israelis hitting your shores for vacation. So it has been more than rumored that the Comoros and the Maldives are the latest countries that could be normalizing. It has been said through diplomatic officials that a statement could be forthcoming relatively soon. So these are two Muslim-majority islands. In the past, Israel has had ties with the Maldives. In 1974, they were suspended because of the Yom Kippur War. And in 2014, following the Gaza War, all agreements were dissolved. But it looks like there is a movement on track for Israel to normalize, and in the case of the Comoros, establish bilateral ties with that. So happy days for Israelis. That means two extra holiday destinations, more places in the world for us to go sell Dead Sea products.
That's wonderful. I really think it is just so positive when I see that, you know, you've got ministers, Israeli ministers, who are meeting with the King of Jordan, when you see that there are conversations, because dialogue is the way to go. You know, we can understand one another.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Yeah. It's very important. You know, last week we spoke about the fact that the Defense Minister Benny Gantz hosted Mahmoud Abbas in his home. Very, very symbolic if you look at Israel, not just regionally, but also internationally. And of course, as you mentioned today, Gantz meeting this morning with King Abdullah from Jordan. Jordan is an ally of Israel. We have a peace agreement, and over the last couple of months, a significant warming in the ties between the two countries. We've seen warming with Egypt as well. So it looks like, you know, as we say, if you reach your hand out in peace to Israel, or if you meet Israel, when we reach out our hand in peace to you, you will receive peace on that end.
Rolene Marks, that is where we leave it, and I look forward to speaking to you again tomorrow. Thank you so much.
Same time tomorrow.
Let's do it all again. Thank you so much, Rolene.